I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the intricate dance of international diplomacy, it is often one step forward, one step back, and one or two steps sideways. In the run-up to the war in Iraq, Russian President Vladimir Putin was a diplomatic Fred Astaire. One step forward, Putin bows to American wishes and casts his Security Council vote in favor of Resolution 1441, telling Saddam Hussein to disarm or else. One step back, Putin balks at American bluster and adopts France and China's anti-war stance. One step sideways, Putin tones down anti-American rhetoric on Russian television and leaves open an invitation for George Bush to join him in St. Petersburg's anniversary celebration next month. Underlying all of it, of course, are Russia's vast economic interests in Iraq, which recent estimates total at $52 billion in oil and construction contracts. Connection listeners, will Russia pay a price, economically and diplomatically, for not getting in line with the U.S.? And how much does America need Russia to help keep the peace and build a new post-war Iraq? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Three guests join me today to guide us through the post-war picture, and we'll be speaking with them in just a moment. First, though, a look at the latest news from Iraq. I spoke just moments ago with John Danichevsky. He is correspondent with the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad.
I'm in the Palestine Hotel. Things are quiet in the city right now. We hear occasionally a lot of looting going on in the city. The looting has sort of gathered steam and it started out being strictly in government buildings, but now it's starting to hit some private businesses and diplomatic installations.
What, if anything, are the U.S. troops doing about it?
Well, I think they're not doing too much about it right now. Try to quell the looting, but they're not here in such great force. And their, I think, first concern now is protecting themselves, because there was another suicide bombing attempt yesterday. They are being very careful at their checkpoints to make sure that no one can approach them. Where cars have been told to stop and have been shot at the checkpoints when they didn't comply with the orders that, in some cases, they may not have understood because they were given in English.
What about that? Is there a way to check people at the checkpoint without exposing yourself to danger?
Safe distance away, and for people to keep their hands in the air until they can be checked and looked over to make sure that they are not a danger.
Although that doesn't really address the issue of someone who has bombs strapped to his body, does it?
No, it really is. It's a very, it's a tense situation for everyone. The people who have to go through these checkpoints and the Marines and soldiers who are facing this great danger.
Now, what we are hearing from the Central Command is that the troops are forbidden to use deadly force to prevent the looting. So how are they able to even have a presence that would discourage it?
It's a good question. They are impressive looking, these troops, with their uniforms and their heavy tanks. And I think people, given a direct order, will respond to them even without deadly force. But the question is, when the Marines go away or turn their backs, they're right in it again. I don't want to give the impression the whole society is engaging in the looting. It's a segment of the society, and the rest of the society is rather terrified by it and worried about their property and their homes, and is asking, pleading for police to come out here and give them back the order that they used to have.
Indeed, we're seeing some reports, John, of a local coffee shop owner, for example, who says, "I can't believe it. Are these really Iraqis? What happened to their honor and their patriotism?" So this must be deeply upsetting to a big segment of the population there.
Right. And I think, of course, a lot of people were very poor. They felt they had they were owed for what they suffered under the previous government, what they were denied, and they feel a sense of entitlement to take things from government buildings or people who they associate with the former regime. Another phenomenon that's taking place is settling of accounts. some people who were henchmen for the Ba'ath Party government, you know, the people who used to be informers or turn in people for deserting and stuff, they're in hiding now, and sometimes they're being chased down by people who have scores to settle with them.
And so that's the next big issue, I would imagine. First the looting, then the revenge killing?
And then you also have the specter of sectarian violence. There are fears among some Christians and Sunnis that the Shia will rise against them, you know, or that minorities will be targeted.
John, one of the things we've heard is that U.S. troops have now set up an operations center where you are at the Palestine Hotel. Is that the case?
That's right. They've fought a pretty formidable blocking the roads to this area. They've sort of moved some of their heavy equipment in the space between the hotel and the river, which is sort of a park-like area. So, yeah, they're setting up here. It's very funny for those of us who have been here and who remember the Fedayeen and the U.S. Marines coming in with their shaved heads and their full combat gear and coming in and lining up for food in the restaurant and sometimes coming up and using the showers.
Also gotten reports of journalists who were trying to talk to looters were themselves robbed.
Yes, it's you know, we just seem to go from one hazard to another around here. So, but fortunately, my colleague Michael Slackman has just driven in from Amman, and he has an armored car with him, so we'll have a degree of security now, I hope.
Well, John, we thank you so much for the update. Stay safe.
Thank you very much.
Again, that was John Danachevsky, a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, reporting to us from Baghdad. And now back to our main topic and guest this hour. Let me introduce them. Marshall Goldman is professor of Russian economics emeritus at Wellesley College and the author, most recently, of The Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, Gail.
Also joining us is Sergei Rogov, director of the Institute of USA in Canada and president of the Center for National Security and International Relations. Hello, Sergei.
Hi, Gail.
And Slava Nikonov is the president of the Polity Foundation and dean of history and political science at the International University in Moscow. Welcome, Slava.
Hello, Gail.
We're delighted to have all three of you with us. Marshall, let me start with you. I wonder if you can give us a little bit of the backstory of the past few months as we try to puzzle this out, because particularly in terms of what President Putin was thinking in first voting for the UN Resolution 1441 and then backing away from a second resolution, and in fact, even joining France and Germany in threatening to veto it if it came to that.
It is a bit strange, and I must confess it surprised me. I did think on the first resolution in the UN that President Putin would do what he did, support the United States, as it were, support the UN resolution, based on the friendship that the two leaders, President Bush and President Putin, had established. It goes beyond politics. There is a deeply religious attitude. They've bonded. I mean, and for that matter, President Bush went to St. Petersburg for 2 or 3 days, which he never goes out of the country for more than a day or two, just because to show his friendship with President Putin. But then, for a variety of reasons that your other two guests, I'm sure, know better than I, there seemed to be some domestic issues that President Putin had to address. The public in Russia, is opposed to what the United States was doing or was going to do in Iraq. And he may have had to respond to that. My own interest was that I found that the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ivanov, was particularly outspoken and in some cases went as far as the French did. And I didn't know if he was pulling President Putin along, but President Putin ultimately came along and began to talk about him. It was a mistake because it was clear the United States was going to do well. And even recently, it looked like he got himself associated with the French and the Germans, who may have given him cover. But this, I think, has left him exposed now. And it's made, I think, people in Washington quite angry, even though, as you mentioned, President Putin seems to have pulled back. and allowed for the United States to go ahead. Now, there's interest now in the reconstruction, and that's going to be controversial, too.
We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, I'm curious, Slava, how all of this maneuvering looked like from Moscow? I mean, Putin is a very popular president. Did he really have to play that strongly to public opinion?
Well, I think there is a sort of overreaction on Putin's side. Of course, he was reacting to the domestic impulses. We are already in the election season. We are having Duma elections December this year and presidential election next spring.
So you start as early as people in America do.
Yeah, we start a little bit earlier than you since our election season is somewhat more a year ahead. Definitely, there were only 2% of the Russians who were supporting the American military operation in Iraq and up to 90% disapproving. That is quite an important and legitimate factor for politicians. Another was the Muslim factor. Up to 10% of the Russian public is Muslim, and this is also a variable in the election year. We had a referendum in Chechnya, where the Muslim factor also was quite an important variable, and the Russian government, Moscow, could not take a too pro-American and anti-Iraqi position at that point. And what I also heard several times in the Kremlin, they're also talking in terms of Russian economic interests, which are closer to Europe. You know that more than a third of Russia's foreign trade is with the European Union, to go up to 50% with the enlargement of the European Union, and only 5% goes to America. So that was important. But anyway, I think with all these arguments, I didn't see any reason why Putin had to react as harsh as he did at the initial stage of the war.
Sergei, I want to bring you into this as well. Is that how you saw it?
Well, very much so. But let me add that unlike 5 years ago during the NATO war in Kosovo, when Russia was almost alone in opposing NATO and the United States' use of force against Yugoslavia, this time the situation was quite different. It's the majority of the international community which disagrees with the United States. And Russia was not leading the anti-American coalition. That was a rather unusual situation for us. Another point is that we believed that the international inspections produce results, that as far as disarming Iraq is concerned, it could be done without the use of military force. And that's why I think we supported the first United Nations resolution, but disagreed with the United States about the need to pass a new resolution authorizing the military operation. And finally, the last point. We don't see Iraq or Iran or North Korea as a threat to Russia.
All right. We're going to continue the conversation in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about Russia and the reconstruction. What role should Russia have in rebuilding post-war Iraq? Does America need Russia's help in keeping the peace and rebuilding there? Or will Vladimir Putin be iced out in a Cold War-style chill? You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection, and we're talking this hour about Russia's role in a post-war Iraq. Will the recent tensions between the United States and Russia leave America's former Cold War foe out in the cold when it comes to rebuilding? Join us. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests in the studio are Marshall Goldman, Sergei Rogov, and Slava Nikonov. Slava, let me start with you on this one. And I'm wondering about one of the reasons that was offered as to why President Putin didn't back a second resolution was that over the years, and particularly with the Bush administration, that Russia had given much and gotten little from the United States. There are now U.S. bases in Central Asia and the Caucasus, NATO's expansion into the Baltics, the Bush administration backing off the ABM treaty. How do you read that?
Well, that's what many of the critics of President Putin are saying these days in Moscow, that, yes, Putin was so pro-American during the last few years, but really got not much, if anything. Well, in my view, Russia should not expect too much. I don't think there is a concept of gratefulness in American foreign policy thought. You know, Americans take many things for granted. This is one thing. Another, I don't think Russia was good enough in formulating its own national interests and really formulating the agenda. Sometimes talking to the U.S. officials, I can hear things like, you know, we ask our Russian counterparts what is they want on certain foreign policy issues, and we do not get the answer.
So they didn't know, or they were unable to articulate it?
Sometimes they do not know. Sometimes they do not want to articulate. There is still no understanding about the possibility of linkages in foreign policy. This is something the foreign ministry doesn't like very much. So, yes, of course, there is a problem of where is the beef in the Russian-American relationship, and that's always the question. But I think it's not only American fault, it's also the Russian fault. In case of Iraq, I think Russia could be extremely more pragmatic, because we acted, there were some anti-American reactions in what we heard during the last weeks or even months. In my view, Russia's interest, the pro-Russian policy, was to do its best not to spoil the relationship with the United States, which I think is the most important relationship for Russia, and second, to secure Russia's economic and political interests in post-Saddam Iraq, since the war was inevitable and the result was predictable. And that's what something the Russian government didn't do. They were speaking too much about international law, which I buy, and about the humanitarian aspects, which I also support. But I think in this particular case, Russian diplomacy could be more pragmatic.
Sergei, there have been a lot of accusations around the world that this is a war that was fought over oil. And the suspicion was that the United States was there only because it wanted control over Iraq's oil field. Now, the other side of that argument says, well, Russia broke from the U.S. on this primarily because of its oil interests. Now, I know you say not so fast on the first part of the argument, and I'd like to hear that from you, but is it no to the second as well?
It is no to both. I think that neither Russia nor the United States has have any vital interests in Iraq. As far as the energy requirements are concerned, Russia is exporting oil and gas, and Russia doesn't need Iraqi's oil for herself. And the United States could buy oil. In fact, well, Saddam Hussein was selling half of oil for food to the United States at an acceptable price.
But Russia got a lot of that as well. I mean, Russia does have huge economic interests there, no?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I would disagree. This is
serious talks about the Russian.
Well, I mean, the Russians are owed about $8 billion from past arms sales and some oil contracts. And here, this is an interesting thing the three of us talked about before, and that is that there seems to be a split between what is in the interests of the Russian government and what may be in the interests of individual Russian businessmen who do see these kinds of things. And this could cause some problems. And I think the
question... Can you really draw that as a distinction?
Well, in some cases you can do that now, because this one company, Lukoil, had some contracts which looked like for a while they may have been broken when the Lukoil became too close to the United States. But they're very much interested in pursuing that, and that's why this began to focus on the question, are we really in there because of the oil? The oil oligarchs, these new people that I try to talk about in my book, now feel that they're independent of the state, or at least independent enough to try to pursue this, and it'll be interesting to see if they will have to go along with Russian interests, or can indeed come back in if we push them out.
Sergei, Marshall, we sort of jumped in on you. Sure, go ahead.
That's exactly why I don't think that Russia has any vital interest. As far as the Iraqi debt to the Soviet Union, nobody is paying Soviet debts to Russia.
Yeah.
It's Russia which is paying Soviet debts to foreign countries. But India is not paying to Russia. Vietnam is not paying to Russia. Nobody does. Why somebody expected Saddam Hussein or post-Saddam regime in Iraq to pay these obligations? And the case of Russian oil companies, they were trying to manipulate Russian foreign policy and present their vested interests as a Russian interest. But from all those oil deals with Saddam, not a single penny would come to Russia. But all this money went to offshore.
Well, it would go offshore, but to these Russian businessmen. And I mean, that's why I say there seems to be this split. Right? I mean, I would agree with Sergey. They don't bring it back home necessarily, but to the extent that the companies are profitable, it ultimately some of it indirectly ends up.
Well, and isn't the bigger issue in terms of oil that Russia needs to keep oil prices at a certain level to support its budget? I mean, if those prices go down, Russia's in trouble.
They have. The originally, prices rose as high as $35 a barrel. They're now in the mid-20s. The Russian budget allows for it to go down to 18 or 14, so they provided for that. But if the more it drops, the less revenue the companies will have, and it will make it a bit more stringent, although I wouldn't want to say everything they earn goes back right to Moscow. It does indeed, much of it does stay offshore.
Let me add that this is a very big problem for Russia, because 25% of all revenues which the Russian federal government gets, we pay to foreign creditors for Soviet debts. And we were able to service these debts only because the oil prices were high. Now we are going to experience, I'm afraid, very serious economic difficulties, which might have domestic political problems for Mr. Putin.
All right.
I would disagree on that.
If you can, quickly, we want to get to our phone lines.
Actually, the Russian foreign debt is going down dramatically, and the average price for oil expected this year is quite good for the Russian budget. It's over 20 on the average.
But it started at 35, and so I mean, we should also forget, as you mentioned, the price of oil also affects Russian oil production, and that's a major thing now. So it's not just Iraqi oil, but if Iraqi oil increases, pushes world's price down, that could hurt domestic, the economy in Russia as well.
All right, let's go to our phones now to Iowa City, Iowa. Zviad is on the line. Hi, Zviad.
Hi. My comment to the question is to both Slava and Sergey. Regarding those demonstrators, 10,000 demonstrators who were against the war near the American embassy in Moscow, why don't they step out against the war in Chechnya? Tens of people are dying probably every week, innocent civilian people in Chechnya, and those are Muslim population, by the way, which Putin cares about. So it looks to me that Putin and the majority of Russian voters don't care about the minorities like Chechens. And the Chechens are being slaughtered, and Russian voters are stepping against the war in Iraq, against the war against Saddam Hussein, not against the Iraqi people.
Thanks for the call, Zviad. Slava, you want to respond?
Well, yes, regrettably, there was not a great protest over the Chechen war. People got used to that war, and now it is not escalating and nothing exciting is happening there, and that's why there is no real emotion about the Chechen war in the Russian society. As for those demonstrations, I would actually stress that there were less demonstrators in Moscow than anywhere else on Earth, actually, including the United States. There are very few demonstrations, and the one which was some days ago was organized by one of the pro-government parties, actually. And that was, I think, a sort of a belated PR campaign of that party and part of the election rather than anything else.
Zviad, I take it you think people should be more emotional about this.
I think that Russian government and probably majority of Russian voters are still thinking in old Soviet way, divide and rule, and I believe that they are carrying out their imperialistic policies towards smaller republics like Chechnya or Georgia or anybody else. Being frank, I just cannot stand how it's all this going on, and I'm very emotional about it because I'm from Georgia, and we have thousands of civilian refugees, Chechens, in Georgia, and not only the Russian government is slaughtering Chechens, but it's also pushing on Georgia for the fact that we keep refugees.
Sergei?
Well, there are some people in Russia who, for political reasons, accuse the United States of American imperialism, so I'm not surprised to hear about Russian imperialism. Today, we experience a situation in Russia when, I'm afraid, most of the public simply doesn't care. And why there were very few people demonstrating against the war in Iraq, or even less against the war in Chechnya? Because most of the public feel that they cannot change anything. And I think this is a reflection of rather frustrated state of Russian society. But there are some political groups who are quite willing to save Arab children in Iraq, forgetting about what's happening to Chechen children in Chechnya.
Sergei, thanks very much for the calls we had. I want to move on to another topic that you have raised in some of your panel discussions about ideology. You've argued that this is really more about ideology, what's happening in Iraq, than it is about economics.
Exactly. We have grown in a country driven by ideology. And sometimes it's forgotten that during the Cold War, it was not only the Soviet Union, but the United States was driven by ideology. And what I see now in Washington, that there is a very ideologically oriented group who during the Cold War wanted a victory, who were against arms control, were against detente, but then they faced a big bad Soviet Union and mutual assured destruction. And they were not dominant. Now there is no Soviet Union. Nobody can balance the American power. And these people preach that it's time to establish for the United States the position of a single superpower. And any legally binding obligations, they're against American interests, because nobody can create, like the Soviet Union could, a symmetrical threat to the United States. And unfortunately, this group today is playing a leading role. But they're the same people who were there during the Cold War. And then they couldn't dictate. Now they do.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Marshall, I want to ask your response to that. Is this really ideologically driven?
I think less so than certainly it was during the Cold War. I mean, communism, we're not fighting communism. But I think there is depends how you define ideology. The ideology that we're presently operating under is that the United States was under a threat after September 11th. And some of these people were saying, well, we now can no longer just rely only on response. We have to preempt. We have to anticipate. We did not anticipate with Osama bin Laden. And indeed, that's what happened. And there's a kind of a fascinating interview that was that I just read with one of Osama bin Laden's lieutenants, who said that the Al Qaeda was impressed by the fact that Americans did not respond forcibly when attacked. This may have gone back to the Clinton administration, and therefore the Bush administration, are not going to get caught in that. And their ideology today is that we have to anticipate and go after these people beforehand. And of course, that makes. That's why Sergei said, Iraq may be a threat, but certainly Iran, North Korea are not. I mean, he, for that matter, even said Iraq is not a threat to Russia's vital interests. So, but Americans now do feel this, and our justification is, look what happened September 11th.
We have a caller on the line now who wants to get into this part of the conversation. Yvonne is here with us from Toronto. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do enjoy your show. And it's a good time to reflect on, just the sort of moral arguments that maybe they've come up when a country like Russia is really needed to give a sober second thought to any effort to wage a war in a very, heated way. And I can't see why there is something wrong with not supporting the United States, and why it is. It's. I get the impression that because a country does not support the United States, it's because they should be denied economic benefits. But I don't think these countries go into would join the war because they think they're going to get an economic benefit, such as these contracts. And this seems to be the impression that the United States is casting around the world, that a war has a certain bounty, and all we have to do is get enough people to join, and, you know, but the humanitarian side is being overlooked, and people lose their lives.
Thanks very much. We take your point. Slava, I wonder if you'd be interested in responding to it. Is this a moral decision that Russia made?
Actually, if you listen to the Russian politicians and decision makers, you'll hear a lot of moral arguments, for sure. And probably the moral arguments would prevail rather than anything else. People would not say that Americans fighting for oil. They would rather say that killing people is not a good endeavor. There is always a moral dilemma. How many people you can afford killing to achieve freedom? And now the count of death in Iraq is quite high. It's tens of thousands of people, if you include the military, and they also have their families, their loved ones, and maybe even eternal soul. So the moral argument is always there, and it is used by politicians, but from some Russian politicians, such kind of arguments do not sound too convincing.
We're talking this hour on The Connection about Russia's roulette with its future. Does the former Soviet superpower need the U.S. now more than ever, or is the opposite true? We're discussing Russia's relevance on the world stage and its economic viability going forward. We invite you to join us when we get back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection on NPR. We're talking this hour about Russia's role in rebuilding Iraq. We're discussing precisely what role the former superpower should have in post-war Iraq, where it has billions of dollars at stake, and even more than dollars. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255 to be part of the conversation. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Sergey, you have said elsewhere that you think President Putin made a big mistake and that in post-war Iraq you are concerned, I believe if I'm remembering this correctly, that the United States is not going to be inclined to be very forgiving. Do you think that there has been irreparable harm to this relationship between the United States and Russia?
No, I don't think so, but the relationship is very fragile. There are several reasons for that. One is that simply Russia and the United States are in different leagues. And unlike the Soviet Union, Russia is not a superpower. The second reason is that the new strategic partnership, which Bush and Putin proclaimed after 9/11, is very much depending on the personal relations between the two presidents. And on both sides, bureaucracy is dragging its feet to do something positive in Russian-American relations. There is a gap between the two presidents and the bureaucracy, in particular the military bureaucracy in the United States and Russia. And that's why cooperation is very limited. Economically, our relationship is very one-sided. But if Russia wants to become a political democracy and market economy, we should belong to the community of democracies and market economy. And the leader of this community, the leader of the West, is the United States. So a confrontation with the United States or deeper divisions within the Western community are not in Russian interests. And I think Putin understands that. So, well, you said that I'm criticizing him. I'm not criticizing him for his policy toward the United States.
Marshall, what about that? It's fine for presidents of countries to have a good personal relationship, but can that be enough to overcome when their interests simply don't coincide?
I don't think it's enough. And indeed, even right now, I think President Bush is probably being pushed by the conservatives around him to say, you've been too close to Russia. Russia sold Russian companies. I wouldn't say the government. Russian companies were accused of selling arms or equipment to Iraq, which, of course, has upset some of the people in the Pentagon. And here, again, is an interesting problem. In times past in the Soviet era, we could simply assume that the government was involved. Now the government says, well, we didn't do it, but private firms who are leading independent lives are able to do it. Again, this is what happens when the market, in a sense, comes. It's going to be difficult. And the question that I think is going to focus in the Congress is who's going to pay for the war. One of your previous callers said, well, we have to worry about the moral thing and we shouldn't fight about who gets the contracts. But if there's going to be a cost and Americans are going to have to bear the cost, I don't think they want to give contracts to Russian companies for the oil, and that's going to get us into all kinds of political disputes. Are we in there for the oil? What's Halliburton doing? What is Cheney's relationship to all this? And so this could be domestically controversial as well as internationally.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. We have a call from Reidsville, North Carolina. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Hey, I'm surprised that I got through. I'm an artist who studied at the Hermitage in 95 and 96, and I got a firsthand picture of what Russia has had to go through with the fall of their government. I believe that Russia has enough on its plate right now to handle what's happening within its own country. I applaud the Russian people that have stood up along with Germany and along with France against this atrocity that our government has done. I'm against this war. I think that Russia learned from Afghanistan, and we should have learned from the Vietnam War that aggression does not work like this. It is wrong, and as far as the economic fall of Russia, I see the same thing happening in this country. I believe that Bush was planned on being president. I believe that there was no way for Bush not to be elected in this country. I think this thing has been calculated. I believe that the war is wrong.
I think we got it, Sheila. I think we got it. Thank you so much for the comment. Slava, I want to ask you to respond to that and also to reflect for a moment about the meeting this weekend with France and Germany. I'm wondering how you imagine what those conversations will sound like.
It's hard for me to imagine. I'm too far away. I am not switched in the Russian political process these days. Well, of course, most of the Russians would agree with this estimate from North Carolina that the war is bad and Russia, France, and Germany were on the right side. My argument is not exactly that. My argument that Russia, taking into account all the moral and legal aspects of the war, should also be more pragmatic, thinking about its own economic and political interests in both Saddam Iraq and in Russian-American bilateral relationship. As for Putin, Chirac, Schroeder, I think for all three of these leaders, it is important to get mutual assurance of doing the right thing because, Chirac is facing, of course, enormous support in his country. Putin Putin's popularity is growing in Russia, but it's not the case for Schroeder. He has hard times in Germany, mostly not because of his position on the war in Iraq, but rather because of economic problems inside the country, which made his rating rather low, about a quarter of the electorate support the policies of nowadays chancellor. So probably for Schroeder, it's even more important than for Putin and for Chirac, in my mind, they still show solidarity. They still demonstrate to their nations that they consider their political line be right. And they really, they're assuring each other of that idea.
I think Putin made a mistake by letting Chirac come to this meeting. Originally, it was going to be between Schroeder and Putin. I mean, Chirac, in, right now, to the United States at least, is bad news, and he continues to be very outspoken after the fact. And I think this is going to damage, I think, American attitudes towards Russia.
And do you think, Marshall, that these three leaders are going to get in a room and basically say, oops, now what?
Well, they don't seem to be. I mean, they're saying what they're saying is that the United Nations should be really take over now, and the United States should step out. What we're saying is we want the United Nations to come in with the humanitarian help, but don't talk to us about the economic spoils, if you will. But it is a source of tension, and Chirac just, you know, being traditionally critical of the United States.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines now. We have Bruce, who is on the road somewhere around Atlanta, calling in on a cell phone. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I have two quick questions. It's been really interesting listening to you. One is, do you think the Americans, you know, tendency to take the moral high ground on opposing activities like Russia and Chechnya, other countries' activities around the world is undermined by basically an very weakly justified invasion in Iraq or in the future? Do you think that position is undermined in the future? And secondly, what do you think about the Bush administration's ability to win the peace, per se, in Iraq, given their, I don't know, apparent or relative ineptness demonstrated so far in international relations and understandings of cultural awareness?
Thanks very much for the call, Bruce. I have three people sitting here nodding at me. Who wants to go first?
Well, let me begin. I think there is a certain amount of, you know, we look at the other side and say they're doing it wrong, and we don't look at ourselves. But I don't think that's going to affect our administration's attitude, particularly because now the war went so quickly, and it looks like, at least in terms of the military response, the United States is going to say, well, we told you we could do it. Bush is going to do it. Rumsfeld's going to do it. But I would agree that what follows afterwards is going to be and could be a nightmare. And already today, it looks like it's beginning to happen. We've got to have control, and it's not going to come easy.
You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Slava, you want to chime in on that point?
I think all politicians are hypocritic, especially when they have to kill people, be it in Chechnya or Iraq. So I would not approve of any governments doing all sort of nasty things. As for winning peace, I think it's winning peace is really more difficult than winning the war. Actually, the United States were not too good in winning peace, like in winning war. I mean Bosnia, which is a mess now. I mean Kosovo, which is even messier. And, of course, I mean Afghanistan, which is an ultimate mess.
Sergei?
2 points. One is that in the Soviet days, our government and the ideological propaganda was promoting the perception that we have imposed social justice on the rest of the world, and we were doing it with tanks and bombs. And the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed more than a decade ago, in my view, is that our people decided, no, we don't want to do it. We want to be like civilized nations. Unfortunately, what we see now is the United States is imposing democracy by bombs and military force, and it's not going to work. But as far as Russian position, French and German today, I think, we will try to avoid the situation when we provide legitimacy to American occupation of Iraq. We will support humanitarian assistance, but hardly we would recognize an American occupation regime there.
I want to widen the lens even a little more, if we can, for just a moment, and get into this notion of the Bush administration seems to be hoping that in the post-war world that other countries that have been giving it problems are going to back off. You know, it's sort of the bully in the playground theory that you don't have to get rid of everyone you don't like, just take care of one, and then everyone else is going to quiet down. And I'm wondering, from each of your perspectives, are countries like Iran, North Korea, Syria more likely to take that lesson now, or to get their own nuclear weapons just as fast as they can if they don't have them already?
I think it's a fascinating question. I think the leaders in many of these countries now have to really step back and say, my goodness, look what the American technology can do. And then, to the support, to the extent that there was support on the street from the public, even though it may have been from Shiites, I think this has to be taken into account. And it I would expect that it would temper some of their behavior, but whether or not it's going to lead everybody to lie down and say, well, do whatever you want in the United States, I'm doubtful. But it's certainly going to cause a change in the leadership thinking all over the world.
Well, from what I know, Iran and North Korea are speeding up their nuclear arms programs to have a bomb and to protect themselves from the U.S. attack. Syria does not have any nuclear capability, so I don't think they'll do that. And the Syrian government may take the message and be somewhat more moderate than it used to be. But as for Iran and North Korea, I think they'll take tougher positions.
I agree with Slava, but I also want to emphasize that probably this is a situation when the United States needs Russian cooperation as much as Russia needs the American cooperation. Because if we're serious about non-proliferation, then, of course, Russia should be a strong partner of the United States. Unfortunately, this is not the case. But I hope that despite the present difficulties between our two countries, the two presidents, when they meet next month in St. Petersburg...
If they do.
I think they will.
Yeah.
Because they both committed to a strong Russian-American partnership. I think they will be able to push the situation forward.
Thank you so much. We'll leave it there for now. I want to thank my guest today. Marshall Goldman is professor of Russian economics emeritus at Wellesley College and the author most recently of The Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry. Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you, Gail.
Sergei Rogov is director of the Institute of USA in Canada. Thank you so much, Sergei.
Thank you, Gail.
And Slava Nikonov is the president of the Policy Foundation. Good to have you with us, Slava.
Thank you again.
Earlier in the program, we heard from John Danachevsky, who was reporting from Baghdad. And Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at www.theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, who leaves today for Baghdad, where he will be co-hosting this program starting early next week. This is The Connection.